Disc 20. The child sat down on the dais beside the throne, dangled her feet over the edge, kicking them. There was such an air of sureness in the way she appraised her surroundings. The Baron stared at the kicking feet, the way they moved the black robe, the wink of sandals beneath the fabric. "Unfortunately," the Emperor said, "I only sent in 5 troop carriers with a light attack force to pick up prisoners for questioning. We barely got away with 3 prisoners and 1 carrier. Mind you, Baron, my Sardaukar were almost overwhelmed by a force composed mostly of women, children, and old men. This child here was in command of one of the attacking groups."
"You see, Your Majesty," the Baron said, "you see how they are."
"I allowed myself to be captured," the child said. "I did not want to face my brother and have to tell him that his son had been killed." "Only a handful of our men got away," the Emperor said. "Got away. You hear that?"
"We'd have had them too," the child said. "Except for the flames."
"My Sardaukar used the attitudinal jets on their carrier as flamethrowers," the Emperor said. "A move of desperation, and the only thing that got them away with their 3 prisoners." "Mark that, my dear Baron. Sardaukar forced to retreat in confusion from women and children and old men." "We must attack in force," the Baron rasped. "We must destroy every last vestige of—"
"Silence!" the Emperor roared.
He pushed himself forward on his throne. "Do not abuse my intelligence any longer. You stand there in your foolish innocence and—"
"Majesty," the old truthsayer said.
He waved her to silence. "You say you don't know about the activity we found, nor the fighting qualities of these superb people." The Emperor lifted himself half off his throne. "What do you take me for, Baron?" The Baron took 2 backward steps, thinking, "It was Rabban. He has done this to me. Rabban has—" "And this fake dispute with Duke Leto," the Emperor purred, sinking back into his throne. "How beautifully you maneuvered it."
"Majesty," the Baron pleaded.
"What are you—"
"Silence!"
The old Bene Gesserit put a hand on the Emperor's shoulder, leaned close to whisper in his ear. The child, seated on the dais, stopped kicking her feet, said,
"Make him afraid some more, Shaddam. I shouldn't enjoy this, but I find the pleasure impossible to suppress."
"Quiet, child," the Emperor said. He leaned forward, put a hand on her head, stared at the Baron. "Is it possible, Baron? Could you be as simple-minded as my truth-sayer suggests? Do you not recognize this child? Daughter of your ally, Duke Leto?"
"My father was never his ally," the child said. "My father is dead, and this old Harkonnen beast has never seen me before."
The Baron was reduced to stupefied glaring. When he found his voice, it was only to rasp,
"Who?" "I am Aaliyah, daughter of Duke Leto and the Lady Jessica, sister of Duke Paul Muad'Dib," the child said. She pushed herself off the dais, dropped to the floor of the audience chamber. "My brother has promised to have your head atop his battle standard, and I think he shall."
"Be hush, child," the Emperor said, and he sank back into his throne, hand to chin, studying the Baron.
"I do not take the Emperor's orders," Aaliyah said. She turned. looked up at the old Reverend Mother. She knows. The Emperor glanced up at his truthsayer. What does she mean? That child is an abomination, the old woman said. Her mother deserves a punishment greater than anything in history. Death. It cannot come too quickly for that child or for the one who spawned her. The old woman pointed a finger at Aaliyah. Get out of my mind. TP, the Emperor whispered. He snapped his attention back to Aaliyah. By the Great Mother. You don't understand, Majesty, the old woman said. Not telepathy. She's in my mind. She's like the ones before me, the ones who gave me their memories. She stands in my mind. She cannot be there, but she is. What others? The Emperor demanded. What's this nonsense? The old woman straightened, lowered her pointing hand. I've said too much, but the fact remains that this child, who is not a child, must be destroyed. Long were we warned against such a one, and how to prevent such a birth, but one of our own has betrayed us. You babble, old woman, Aaliyah said. You don't know how it was, yet you rattle on like a purblind fool. Aaliyah closed her eyes, took a deep breath, and held it. The old Reverend Mother groaned and staggered. Aaliyah opened her eyes. That is how it was, she said. A cosmic accident. And you played your part in it. The Reverend Mother held out both hands, palms pushing the air toward Aaliyah. What is happening here? The Emperor demanded. Child, can you truly project your thoughts into the mind of another? That's not how it is at all, Aaliyah said. Unless I'm born as you, I cannot think as you. Kill her, the old woman muttered, and clutched the back of the throne for support. Kill her! The sunken old eyes glared at Aaliyah. Silence, the Emperor said, and he studied Aaliyah. Child, can you communicate with your brother? My brother knows I'm here, Aaliyah said. Can you tell him to surrender as the price of your life? Aaliyah smiled up at him with clear innocence. I shall not do that, she said. The Baron stumbled forward to stand beside Aaliyah. Majesty, he pleaded, I knew nothing of... Interrupt me once more, Baron, the Emperor said, and you will lose the powers of interruption forever. He kept his attention focused on Aaliyah, studying her through slitted lids. You will not, eh? Can you read in my mind what I'll do if you disobey me? I've already said I cannot read minds, she said. But one doesn't need telepathy to read your intentions. The Emperor scowled. Child, your cause is hopeless. I have but to rally my forces and reduce this planet to... It's not that simple, Aaliyah said. She looked at the two guildsmen. Ask them. It is not wise to go against my desires, the Emperor said. You should not deny me the least thing. My brother comes now, Aaliyah said. Even an emperor may tremble before Muad'Dib, for he has the strength of righteousness, and heaven smiles upon him. The Emperor surged to his feet. This play has gone far enough. I will take your brother and this planet and grind them to... The room rumbled and shook around them.
There came a sudden cascade of sand behind the throne where the hutment was coupled to the Emperor's ship. The abrupt flicker tightening of skin pressure told of a wide area shield being activated.
"I told you," Aaliyah said. "My brother comes."
The Emperor stood in front of his throne, right hand pressed to right ear, the servo receiver there chattering its report on the situation. The Baron moved two steps behind Aaliyah. Sardaukar were leaping to positions at the doors. "We will fall back into space and reform," the Emperor said. "Baron, my apologies. These madmen are attacking under cover of the storm. We will show them an emperor's wrath, then." He pointed at Aaliyah. "Give her body to the storm." As he spoke, Aaliyah fled backward, feigning terror. "Let the storm have what it can take," she screamed, and she backed into the Baron's arms. "I have her, Majesty," the Baron shouted. "Shall I dispatch her now?" "Ah!" He hurled her to the floor, clutched his left arm.
"I'm sorry, Grandfather," Aaliyah said. "You've met the Atreides Gom Jabbar."
She got to her feet, dropped a dark needle from her hand. The Baron fell back. His eyes bulged as he stared at a red slash on his left palm.
You...
He rolled sideways in his suspensors, a sagging mass of flesh supported inches off the floor, with head lolling and mouth hanging open. "These people are insane," the Emperor snarled. "Quick, into the ship! We'll purge this planet of every..." Something sparkled to his left. A roll of ball lightning bounced away from the wall there, crackled as it touched the metal floor. The smell of burned insulation swept through the Salem leak.
"The shield!" one of the Sardaukar officers shouted. "The outer shield is down! They..."
His words were drowned in a metallic roaring as the ship wall behind the Emperor trembled and rocked.
"They've shot the nose off our ship," someone called.
Dust boiled through the room. Under its cover, Aaliyah leaped up, ran toward the outer door. The Emperor whirled, motioned his people into an emergency door that swung open in the ship's side behind the throne. He flashed a hand signal to a Sardaukar officer leaping through the dust haze. "We will make our stand here," the Emperor ordered. Another crash shook the hutment. The double doors banged open at the far side of the chamber, admitting wind-blown sand and the sound of shouting. A small, black-robed figure could be seen momentarily against the light. Aaliyah darting out to find a knife, and, as befitted her Fremen training, to kill a Harkonnen and Sardaukar wounded. House Sardaukar charged through a green-yellow haze toward the opening, weapons ready, forming an arc there to protect the Emperor's retreat.
"Save yourself, sire," a Sardaukar officer shouted. "Into the ship!"
But the Emperor stood alone now on his dais, pointing toward the doors. A 40-meter section of the hutment had been blasted away there, and the Salem Leak's doors opened now onto drifting sand. A dust cloud hung low over the outside world, blowing from pastel distances. Static lightning crackled from the cloud, and the spark flashes of shields being shorted out by the storm's charge could be seen through the haze. The plain surged with figures in combat. Sardaukar and leaping, gyrating, robed men who seemed to come down out of the storm. All this was as a frame for the target of the Emperor's pointing hand. Out of the sand haze came an orderly mass of flashing shapes. Great rising curves with crystal spokes that resolved into the gaping mouths of sandworms. A massed wall of them, each with troops of Fremen riding to the attack.
They came in a hissing wedge, robes whipping in the wind as they cut through the melee on the plain. Onward toward the Emperor's hutment they came, while the House Sardaukar stood awed, for the first time in their history, by an onslaught their minds found difficult to accept. But the figures leaping from the worm backs were men, and the blades flashing in that ominous yellow light were a thing the Sardaukar had been trained to face. They threw themselves into combat, and it was man to man on the plain of Arakeen, while a picked Sardaukar bodyguard pressed the Emperor back into the ship, sealed the door on him, and prepared to die at that door as part of his shield. In the shock of comparative silence within the ship, the Emperor stared at the wide-eyed faces of his suite, seeing his oldest daughter with the flush of exertion on her cheeks, the old truth-sayer standing like a black shadow with her hood pulled about her face, finding at last the faces he sought, the two guildsmen. They wore the guild gray, unadorned, and it seemed to fit the calm they maintained despite the high emotions around them. The taller of the two, though, held a hand to his left eye. As the Emperor watched, someone jostled the guildsman's arm. The hand moved, and the eye was revealed. The man had lost one of his masking contact lenses, and the eye stared out a total blue so dark as to be almost black. The smaller of the pair elbowed his way a step nearer the Emperor, said, "We cannot know how it will go." And the taller companion, hand restored to eye, added in a cold voice, "But this Muad'Dib cannot know either." The words shocked the Emperor out of his daze. He checked the scorn on his tongue by a visible effort, because it did not take a guild navigator's single-minded focus on the main chance to see the immediate future out on that plain. Were these two so dependent upon their faculty that they had lost the use of their eyes and their reason, he wondered. "Reverend Mother," he said, "we must devise a plan." She pulled the hood from her face, met his gaze with an unblinking stare. The look that passed between them carried complete understanding. They had one weapon left, and both knew it. Treachery. "Summon Count Fenring from his quarters," the Reverend Mother said. The Padishah Emperor nodded, waved for one of his aides to obey that command. It was warrior and mystic, ogre and saint, the fox and the innocent, chivalrous, ruthless, less than a god, more than a man. There is no measuring Muad'Dib's motives by ordinary standards. In the moment of his triumph, he saw the death prepared for him, yet he accepted the treachery. Can you say he did this out of a sense of justice? Whose justice, then? Remember, we speak now of the Muad'Dib who ordered battle drums made from his enemies' skins, the Muad'Dib who denied the conventions of his ducal past with a wave of the hand, saying merely, "I am the Kwisatz Haderach." That is reason enough. From Arrakis Awakening by the Princess Irulan. It was to the Arakeen governor's mansion, the old residency the Atreides had first occupied on Dune, that they escorted Paul Muad'Dib on the evening of his victory. The building stood as Rabban had restored it, virtually untouched by the fighting, although there had been looting by townspeople. Some of the furnishings in the main hall had been overturned or smashed. Paul strode through the main entrance with Gurney Halleck and Stilgar a pace behind. Their escort fanned out into the great hall, straightening the place and clearing an area for Muad'Dib. One squad began investigating that no sly trap had been planted here. I remember the day we first came here with your father, Gurney said. He glanced around at the beams and the high, slitted windows. I didn't like this place then, and I like it less now. One of our caves would be safer. Spoken like a true Fremen, Stilgar said, and he marked the cold smile that his words brought to Muad'Dib's lips. Will you reconsider, Muad'Dib? This place is a symbol, Paul said. Reban lived here. By occupying this place, I seal my victory for all to understand. Send men through the building. Touch nothing. Just be certain no Harkonnen people or toys remain. As you command, Stilgar said, and reluctance was heavy in his tone as he turned to obey. Communications men hurried into the room with their equipment, began setting up near the massive fireplace. The Fremen guard that augmented the surviving Fedaiken took up stations around the room. There was muttering among them, much darting of suspicious glances. This had been too long a place of the enemy for them to accept their presence in it casually. Gurney, have an escort bring my mother and Chaney, Paul said. Does Chaney know yet about our son?
The message was sent, my lord.
Are the makers being taken out of the basin yet?
Yes, my lord. The storm's almost spent.
What's the extent of the storm damage? Paul asked.
In the direct path, on the land and field, and across the spice storage yards of the plain?
Extensive damage, Gurney said. As much from battle as from the storm.
Nothing money won't repair, I presume, Paul said.
Except for the lives, my lord, Gurney said. And there was a tone of reproach in his voice, as though to say, when did an Atreides worry first about things when people were at stake? But Paul could only focus his attention on the inner eye and the gaps visible to him in the time wall that still lay across his path. Through each gap, the jihad raged away down the corridors of the future. He sighed, crossed the hall, seeing a chair against the wall. The chair had once stood in the dining hall and might even have held his own father. At the moment, though, it was only an object to rest his weariness and conceal it from the men. He sat down, pulling his robes around his legs, loosening his stillsuit at the neck.
The Emperor is still holed up in the remains of his ship, Gurney said.
For now, contain him there, Paul said. Have they found the Harkonnens yet?
They're still examining the dead.
What reply from the ships up there? He jerked his chin toward the ceiling.
No reply yet, my lord.
Paul sighed, resting against the back of his chair. Presently he said, bring me a captive Sardaukar. We must send a message to our emperor. It's time to discuss terms.
Yes, my lord.
Gurney turned away, dropped a hand signal to one of the Fedaiken who took up close guard position beside Paul. Gurney, Paul whispered, since we've been rejoined, I've yet to hear you produce the proper quotation for the event. He turned, saw Gurney swallow, saw the sudden, grim hardening of the man's jaw.
As you wish, my lord, Gurney said.
He cleared his throat, rasped, and the victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. For the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. Paul closed his eyes, forcing grief out of his mind, letting it wait as he had once waited to mourn his father. Now he gave his thoughts over to this day's accumulated discoveries, the mixed futures and the hidden presence of Aaliyah within his awareness. Of all the uses of time vision, this was the strangest.
I have breasted the future to place my words where only you can hear them, Aaliyah had said. Even you cannot do that, my brother. I find it an interesting play. And Oh, yes. I've killed our grandfather, the demented old Baron. He had very little pain.
Silence. His time sense had seen her withdrawal.
Muad'Dib.
Paul opened his eyes to see Stilgar's black-bearded visage above him, the dark eyes glaring with battle light.
You found the body of the old Baron, Paul said.
A hush of the person settled over Stilgar.
How could you know? He whispered. We just found the body in that great pile of metal the Emperor built.
Paul ignored the question, seeing Gurney return accompanied by two Fremen who supported a captive Sardaukar.
Here's one of them, my lord, Gurney said.
He signed to the guard to hold the captive 5 paces in front of Paul. The Sardaukar's eyes, Paul noted, carried a glazed expression of shock. A blue bruise stretched from the bridge of his nose to the corner of his mouth. He was of the blonde, chisel-featured cast, the look that seemed synonymous with rank among the Sardaukar, yet there were no insignia on his torn uniform except the gold buttons with the imperial crest and the tattered braid of his trousers.
I think this one's an officer, my lord, Gurney said.
Paul nodded, said, I am the Duke Paul Atreides. Do you understand that, man? The Sardaukar stared at him, unmoving. Speak up, Paul said, or your emperor may die. The man blinked, swallowed.
Who am I? Paul demanded.
You are the Duke Paul Atreides, the man husked. He seemed too submissive to Paul. But then the Sardaukar had never been prepared for such happenings as this day. They'd never known anything but victory, which, Paul realized, could be a weakness in itself. He put that thought aside for later consideration in his own training program.
I have a message for you to carry to the Emperor, Paul said,
and he couched his words in the ancient formula.
I, a duke of a great house, an imperial kinsman, give my word of bond under the convention. If the emperor and his people lay down their arms and come to me here, I will guard their lives with my own.
Paul held up his left hand with a ducal signet for the Sardaukar to see.
I swear it by this.
The man wet his lips with his tongue, glanced at Gurney.
Yes, Paul said. Who but an Atreides could command the allegiance of Gurney Halleck?
I will carry the message, the Sardaukar said.
Take him to our forward command post and send him in, Paul said.
Yes, my lord. Gurney motioned for the guard to obey, led them out. Paul turned back to Stilgar.
Chaney and your mother have arrived, Stilgar said. Chaney has asked time to be alone with her grief. The Reverend Mother sought a moment in the Weirding Room. I know not why.
My mother's sick with longing for a planet she may never see, Paul said. Where water falls from the sky and plants grow so thickly you cannot walk between them.
Water from the sky, Stilgar whispered.
In that instant, Paul saw how Stilgar had been transformed from the Fremen Naib to a creature of the Lizan al-Ghaib, a receptacle for awe and obedience. It was a lessening of the man, and Paul felt the ghost wind of the jihad in it.
I have seen a friend become a worshiper, he thought.
In a rush of loneliness, Paul glanced around the room, noting how proper and on review his guards had become in his presence. He sensed the subtle, prideful competition among them, each hoping for notice from Muad'Dib.
Muad'Dib, from whom all blessings flow, he thought,
and it was the bitterest thought of his life. They sense that I must take the throne, he thought. But they cannot know I do it to prevent the jihad. Stilgar cleared his throat, said, Rabban, too, is dead. Paul nodded. Guards to the right suddenly snapped aside, standing at attention to open an aisle for Jessica. She wore her black abba and walked with a hint of striding across sand, but Paul noted how this house had restored to her something of what she had once been here, concubine to a ruling duke. Her presence carried some of its old assertiveness. Jessica stopped in front of Paul, looked down at him. She saw his fatigue and how he hid it, but found no compassion for him. It was as though she had been rendered incapable of any emotion for her son. Jessica had entered the great hall wondering why the place refused to fit itself snugly into her memories. It remained a foreign room, as though she had never walked here. Never walked here with her beloved Leto. Never confronted a drunken Duncan Idaho here. Never, never, never. There should be a word tension directly opposite to Adab, the demanding memory, she thought. There should be a word for memories that deny themselves. Where is Aaliyah? She asked. Out doing what any good Fremen child should be doing in such times, Paul said. She's killing enemy wounded and marking their bodies for the water recovery teams. Paul! You must understand that she does this out of kindness, he said. Isn't it odd how we misunderstand the hidden unity of kindness and cruelty? Jessica glared at her son, shocked by the profound change in him. Was it his child's death did this, she wondered. And she said, The men tell strange stories of you, Paul. They say you've all the powers of the legend. Nothing can be hidden from you, that you see where others cannot see. A Bene Gesserit should ask about legends, he asked. I've had a hand in whatever you are, she admitted. But you mustn't expect me to. How would you like to live billions upon billions of lives, Paul asked. There's a fabric of legends for you. Think of all those experiences, the wisdom they'd bring. But wisdom tempers love, doesn't it? And it puts a new shape on hate. How can you tell what's ruthless unless you've plumbed the depths of both cruelty and kindness? You should fear me, Mother. I am the Kwisatz Haderach. Jessica tried to swallow in a dry throat. Presently she said, Once you denied to me that you were the Kwisatz Haderach. Paul shook his head. I can deny nothing anymore. He looked up into her eyes. The Emperor and his people come now. They will be announced any moment. Stand beside me. I wish a clear view of them. My future bride will be among them. Paul, Jessica snapped, don't make the mistake your father made. She's a princess, Paul said. She's my key to the throne, and that's all she'll ever be. Mistake? You think because I'm what you made me that I cannot feel the need for revenge? Even on the innocent, she asked, and she thought, he must not make the mistakes I made. There are no innocent anymore, Paul said. Tell that to Cheney, Jessica said, and gestured toward the passage from the rear of the residency. Cheney entered the great hall there, walking between the Fremen guards as though unaware of them. Her hood and stillsuit cap were thrown back, face mask fastened aside.
She walked with a fragile uncertainty as she crossed the room to stand beside Jessica. Paul saw the marks of tears on her cheeks. She gives water to the dead. He felt a pang of grief strike through him, but it was as though he could only feel this thing through Chaney's presence.
"He is dead, beloved," Chaney said. "Our son is dead."
Holding himself under stiff control, Paul got to his feet. He reached out, touched Chaney's cheek, feeling the dampness of her tears.
"He cannot be replaced," Paul said, "but there will be other sons. It is Usul who promises this."
Gently he moved her aside, gestured to Stilgar.
"Muad'Dib," Stilgar said.
"They come from the ship, the Emperor and his people," Paul said.
"I will stand here. Assemble the captives in an open space in the center of the room. They will be kept at a distance of 10 meters from me unless I command otherwise."
"As you command, Muad'Dib."
As Stilgar turned to obey, Paul heard the awed muttering of Fremen guards.
"You see? He knew. No one told him, but he knew."
The Emperor's entourage could be heard approaching now, his Sardaukar humming one of their marching tunes to keep up their spirits. There came a murmur of voices at the entrance, and Gurney Halleck passed through the guard, crossed to confer with Stilgar, then moved to Paul's side, a strange look in his eyes.
"Will I lose Gurney too?" Paul wondered.
"The way I lost Stilgar. Losing a friend to gain a creature?"
"They have no throwing weapons," Gurney said. "I've made sure of that myself."
He glanced around the room, seeing Paul's preparations.
"Feyd-Rautha the Harkonnen is with them. Shall I cut him out?"
"Leave him."
"There are some guild people, too, demanding special privileges, threatening an embargo against Arrakis. I told them I'd give you their message."
"Let them threaten."
"Paul," Jessica hissed behind him. "He's talking about the guild."
"I'll pull their fangs presently," Paul said.
And he thought then about the guild, the force that had specialized for so long that it had become a parasite, unable to exist independently of the life upon which it fed. They had never dared grasp the sword, and now they could not grasp it. They might have taken Arrakis when they realized the error of specializing on the Mélange awareness spectrum narcotic for their navigators. They could have done this, lived their glorious day, and died. Instead, they'd existed from moment to moment, hoping the seas in which they swam might produce a new host when the old one died. The Guild navigators, gifted with limited prescience, had made the fatal decision. They'd chosen always the clear, safe course that leads ever downward into stagnation. Let them look closely at their new host, Paul thought.
"There's also a Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother who says she's a friend of your mother," Gurney said.
"My mother has no Bene Gesserit friends."
Again, Gurney glanced around the great hall, then bent close to Paul's ear.
"Thufir Hawat's with him, my lord. I had no chance to see him alone, but used our old hand signs to say he's been working with the Harkonnens. Thought you were dead. Says he's to be left among them."
"You left Thufir among those?"
"He wanted it, and I thought it best. If there's something wrong, he's where we can control him. If not, we've an ear on the other side."
Paul thought then of prescient glimpses into the possibilities of this moment, and one timeline where Thufir carried a poisoned needle, which the Emperor commanded he use against this upstart duke. The entrance guards stepped aside, formed a short corridor of lances. There came a murmurous swish of garments, feet rasping the sand that had drifted into the residency. The Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV led his people into the hall. His Berserk helmet had been lost, and the red hair stood out in disarray. His uniform's left sleeve had been ripped along the inner seam. He was beltless and without weapons, but his presence moved with him like a force field bubble that kept his immediate area open. A Fremen lance dropped across his path, stopped him where Paul had ordered. The others bunched up behind, a montage of color, of shuffling, and of staring faces. Paul swept his gaze across the group, saw women who hid signs of weeping, saw the lackeys who had come to enjoy grandstand seats at a Sardaukar victory, and now stood choked to silence by defeat. Paul saw the bird-bright eyes of the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam glaring beneath her black hood, and beside her the narrow furtiveness of Fade Rautha Harkonnen. "There's a face time betrayed to me," Paul thought. He looked beyond Fade Rautha then, attracted by a movement, seeing there a narrow, weaselish face he'd never before encountered. Not in time or out of it. It was a face he felt he should know, and the feeling carried with it a marker of fear. "Why should I fear that man?" he wondered. He leaned toward his mother, whispered, "That man to the left of the Reverend Mother, the evil-looking one. Who is that?" Jessica looked, recognizing the face from her duke's dossiers. "Count Fenring," she said. "The one who was here immediately before us. A genetic eunuch and a killer." The Emperor's errand boy, Paul thought. And the thought was a shock crashing across his consciousness, because he had seen the Emperor in uncounted associations spread through the possible futures. But never once had Count Fenring appeared within those prescient visions. It occurred to Paul then that he had seen his own dead body along countless reaches of the time web, but never once had he seen his moment of death. "Have I been denied a glimpse of this man because he is the one who kills me?" Paul wondered. The thought sent a pang of foreboding through him. He forced his attention away from Fenring, looked now at the remnants of Sardaukar men and officers, the bitterness on their faces, and the desperation. Here and there among them, faces caught Paul's attention briefly. Sardaukar officers measuring the preparations within this room, planning and scheming yet for a way to turn defeat into victory. Paul's attention came at last to a tall blonde woman, green-eyed, a face of patrician beauty, classic in its hauteur, untouched by tears, completely undefeated. Without being told it, Paul knew her. Princess Royal, Bene Gesserit trained, a face that time vision had shown him in many aspects. Irulan. "There's my key," he thought. Then he saw movement in the clustered people. A face and figure emerged. Thufir Hawat. The seamed old features with darkly stained lips. The hunched shoulders. The look of fragile age about him. "There's Thufir Hawat," Paul said. "Let him stand free, Gurney." "My lord," Gurney said. Let him stand free, Paul repeated. Gurney nodded. Hawat shambled forward as a Fremen lance was lifted and replaced behind him. The rheumy eyes peered at Paul, measuring, seeking. Paul stepped forward one pace, sensed the tense, waiting movement of the Emperor and his people. Hawat's gaze stabbed past Paul, and the old man said, Lady Jessica, I but learned this day how I've wronged you in my thoughts. You needn't forgive. Paul waited, but his mother remained silent. Thufir, old friend, Paul said. As you can see, my back is toward no door. The universe is full of doors, Hawat said. Am I my father's son? Paul asked. More like your grandfather's, Hawat rasped. You've his manner, and the look of him in your eyes. Yet I'm my father's son, Paul said. For I say to you, Thufir, that in payment for your years of service to my family, you may now ask anything you wish of me. Anything at all. Do you need my life now, Thufir? It is yours. Paul stepped forward a pace, hands at his side, seeing the look of awareness grow in Hawat's eyes. He realizes that I know of the treachery, Paul thought. Pitching his voice to carry in a half-whisper for Hawat's ears alone, Paul said, I mean this, Thufir. If you're to strike me, do it now. I but wanted to stand before you once more, my duke, Hawat said. And Paul became aware for the first time of the effort the old man exerted to keep from falling. Paul reached out, supported Hawat by the shoulders, feeling the muscle tremors beneath his hands. Is there pain, old friend? Paul asked. There is pain, my duke, Hawat agreed, but the pleasure is greater. He half turned in Paul's arms, extended his left hand, palm up toward the Emperor, exposing the tiny needle cupped against the fingers. See, Majesty, he called. See your traitor's needle? Did you think that I, who have given my life to service of the Atreides, would give them less now? Paul staggered as the old man sagged in his arms, felt the death there, the utter flaccidity. Gently, Paul lowered Hawat to the floor, straightened, and signed for guardsmen to carry the body away. Silence held the hall while his command was obeyed. A look of deadly waiting held the Emperor's face now. Eyes that had never admitted fear admitted it at last. Majesty, Paul said, and noted the jerk of surprised attention in the tall Princess Royal. The words had been uttered with the Bene Gesserit-controlled atonals, carrying in it every shade of contempt and scorn that Paul could put there. Bene Gesserit trained indeed, Paul thought. The Emperor cleared his throat, said, Perhaps my respected kinsman believes he has things all his own way now. Nothing could be more remote from fact. You have violated the convention, used atomics against... I used atomics against a natural feature of the desert, Paul said. It was in my way, and I was in a hurry to get to you, Majesty, to ask your explanation for some of your strange activities. There's a massed armada of the great houses in space over Arrakis right now, the Emperor said. I've but to say the word and they'll... Oh, yes, Paul said. I almost forgot about them. He searched through the Emperor's suite until he saw the faces of two guildsmen, spoke aside to Gurney. "Are those the guild agents, Gurney? The two fat ones dressed in gray over there?"
"Yes, my lord."
"You two," Paul said, pointing. "Get out of there immediately and dispatch messages that will get that fleet on its way home. After this, you will ask my permission before—"
"The guild doesn't take your orders," the taller of the two barked.
He and his companion pushed through to the barrier lances, which were raised at a nod from Paul. The two men stepped out, and the taller leveled an arm at Paul, said,
"You may very well be under embargo for your—"
"If I hear any more nonsense from either of you," Paul said, "I'll give the order that'll destroy all spice production on Arrakis. Forever."
"Are you mad?" the tall guildsman demanded.
He fell back half a step.
"You grant that I have the power to do this thing, then?" Paul asked.
The guildsman seemed to stare into space for a moment. Then,
"Yes, you could do it, but you must not."
"Ah," Paul said and nodded to himself.
"Guild navigators. Both of you, eh?"
"Yes."
The shorter of the pair said, "You would blind yourself, too, and condemn us all to slow death. Have you any idea what it means to be deprived of the spice liquor once you're addicted?"
"The eye that looks ahead to the safe course is closed forever," Paul said.
"The guild is crippled. Humans become little isolated clusters on their isolated planets. You know, I might do this thing out of pure spite. Or out of ennui."
"Let us talk this over privately," the taller guildsman said. "I'm sure we can come to some compromise that is—"
"Send the message to your people over Arrakis," Paul said.
"I grow tired of this argument. If that fleet over us doesn't leave soon, there'll be no need for us to talk."
He nodded toward his communications man at the side of the hall. "You may use our equipment."
"First, we must discuss this," the tall guildsman said. "We cannot just do it," Paul barked. "The power to destroy a thing is the absolute control over it.
You've agreed I have that power. We are not here to discuss, or to negotiate, or to compromise. You will obey my orders or suffer the immediate consequences."
"He means it," the shorter guildsman said, and Paul saw the fear grip them.
Slowly, the two crossed to the Fremen communications equipment.
"Will they obey?" Gurney asked.
"They have a narrow vision of time," Paul said. "They can see ahead to a blank wall marking the consequences of disobedience. Every guild navigator on every ship over us can look ahead to that same wall. They'll obey."
Paul turned back to look at the Emperor, said, "When they permitted you to mount your father's throne, it was only on the assurance that you'd keep the spice flowing. You failed them, Majesty. Do you know the consequences?"
"Nobody permitted me to—"
"Stop playing the fool," Paul barked. "The guild is like a village beside a river. They need the water, but they can only dip out what they require. They cannot dam the river and control it, because that focuses attention on what they take. It brings down eventual destruction. The spice flow, that's their river. And I have built a dam. But my dam is such that you cannot destroy it without destroying the river."
The Emperor brushed a hand through his red hair, glanced at the backs of the two guildsmen.
Even your Bene Gesserit truth-sayer is trembling, Paul said. There are other poisons the reverend mothers can use for their tricks, but once they've used the spice liquor, the others no longer work. The old woman pulled her shapeless black robes around her, pressed forward out of the crowd to stand at the barrier lances. Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, Paul said. It has been a long time since Caladan, hasn't it? She looked past him at his mother, said, Well, Jessica, I see that your son is indeed the one. For that you can be forgiven even the abomination of your daughter. Paul stilled a cold, piercing anger, said, You've never had the right or cause to forgive my mother anything. The old woman locked eyes with him. Try your tricks on me, old witch, Paul said. Where's your Gom Jabbar? Try looking into that place where you dare not look. You'll find me there staring out at you. The old woman dropped her gaze. Have you nothing to say? Paul demanded. I welcomed you to the ranks of humans, she muttered. Don't besmirch that. Paul raised his voice. Observe her, comrades. This is a Bene Gesserit reverend mother, patient in a patient cause. She could wait with her sisters 90 generations for the proper combination of genes and environment to produce the one person their schemes required. Observe her. She knows now that the 90 generations have produced that person. Here I stand. But I will never do her bidding. Jessica, the old woman screamed, silence him. Silence him yourself, Jessica said. Paul glared at the old woman. For your part in all this, I could gladly have you strangled, he said. You couldn't prevent it, he snapped as she stiffened in rage. But I think it better punishment that you live out your years, never able to touch me or bend me to a single thing your scheming desires. Jessica, what have you done? The old woman demanded. I'll give you only one thing, Paul said. You saw part of what the race needs. But how poorly you saw it. You think to control human breeding and intermix a select few according to your master plan. How little you understand of what... You mustn't speak of these things, the old woman hissed. Silence, Paul roared. The word seemed to take substance as it twisted through the air between them under Paul's control. The old woman reeled back into the arms of those behind her, face blank with shock at the power with which he had seized her psyche. Jessica, she whispered. Jessica. I remember your Gom Jabbar, Paul said. You remember mine. I can kill you with a word. The Fremen around the hall glanced knowingly at each other. Did the legend not say, And his word shall carry death eternal to those who stand against righteousness? Paul turned his attention to the tall princess royal standing beside her emperor father. Keeping his eyes focused on her, he said, Majesty, we both know the way out of our difficulty. The emperor glanced at his daughter, back to Paul. You dare. You, an adventurer without family, a nobody from... You've already admitted who I am, Paul said.
Royal kinsman, you said. Let's stop this nonsense.
I am your ruler, the Emperor said.
Paul glanced at the guildsmen standing now at the communications equipment and facing him. One of them nodded.
I could force it, Paul said. You will not dare, the Emperor grated.
Paul merely stared at him. The Princess Royal put a hand on her father's arm. Father, she said, and her voice was silky soft, soothing.
Don't try your tricks on me, the Emperor said.
He looked at her.
You don't need to do this, daughter. We've other resources that...
But here's a man, fit to be your son, she said. The old Reverend Mother, her composure regained, forced her way to the Emperor's side, leaned close to his ear, and whispered.
She pleads your case, Jessica said.
Paul continued to look at the golden-haired princess. Aside to his mother, he said, That's Irulan, the oldest, isn't it?
Yes.
Chaney moved up on Paul's other side, said,
Do you wish me to leave, Muad'Dib?
He glanced at her.
Leave?
You will never again leave my side.
There's nothing binding between us, Chaney said.
Paul looked down at her for a silent moment, then, Speak only truth with me, Masihaya. As she started to reply, he silenced her with a finger to her lips.
That which binds us cannot be loosed, he said.
Now, watch these matters closely, for I wish to see this room later through your wisdom. The Emperor and his truth-sayer were carrying on a heated, low-voiced argument. Paul spoke to his mother. She reminds him that it's part of their agreement to place a Bene Gesserit on the throne, and Irulan is the one they've groomed for it.
Was that their plan? Jessica said.
Isn't it obvious? Paul asked.
I see the signs, Jessica snapped. My question was meant to remind you that you should not try to teach me those matters in which I instructed you.
Paul glanced at her, caught a cold smile on her lips. Gurney Halleck leaned between them, said,
I remind you, my lord, that there is a Harkonnen in that bunch.
He nodded toward the dark-haired Faderatha pressed against a barrier lance on the left.
The one with the squinting eyes there on the left. As evil a face as I ever saw.
You promised me once that...
Thank you, Gurney, Paul said.
It's the Nabaron. Baron, now that the old man's dead, Gurney said.
He'll do for what I've... Can you take him, Gurney?
My lord jests.
That argument between the Emperor and his witch has gone on long enough, don't you think, Mother? She nodded.
Indeed.
Paul raised his voice, called out to the Emperor.
Majesty, is there a Harkonnen among you?
Royal disdain revealed itself in the way the Emperor turned to look at Paul.
I believe my entourage has been placed under the protection of your ducal word, he said.
My question was for information only, Paul said.
I wish to know if a Harkonnen is officially a part of your entourage, or if a Harkonnen is merely hiding behind a technicality out of cowardice.
The Emperor's smile was calculating. Anyone accepted into the Imperial Company is a member of my entourage.
You have the word of a duke, Paul said. But Muad'Dib is another matter.
He may not recognize your definition of what constitutes an entourage.
My friend Gurney Halleck wishes to kill a Harkonnen. If he... Conley, Fade Rautha shouted. He pressed against the barrier lance. Your father named this vendetta Atreides. You call me coward while you hide among your women and offer to send a lackey against me. The old truthsayer whispered something fiercely into the emperor's ear, but he pushed her aside, said, Conley, is it? There are strict rules for Conley.
Paul, put a stop to this, Jessica said.
M'lord, Gurney said, you promised me my day against the Harkonnens.
You've had your day against them, Paul said, and he felt a harlequin abandon take over his emotions. He slipped his robe and hood from his shoulders, handed them to his mother with his belt and kris-knife, began unstrapping his stillsuit. He sensed now that the universe focused on this moment.
There's no need for this, Jessica said. There are easier ways, Paul.
Paul stepped out of his stillsuit, slipped the kris-knife from its sheath in his mother's hand.
I know, he said.
Poison, an assassin, all the old familiar ways.
You promised me a Harkonnen, Gurney hissed,
and Paul marked the rage in the man's face, the way the ink vine scar stood out dark and ridged.
You owe it to me, my lord.
Have you suffered more from them than I? Paul asked.
My sister, Gurney rasped. My years in the slave pits.
My father, Paul said. My good friends and companions, Thufir Hawat and Duncan Idaho. My years as a fugitive without rank or succor. And one more thing. It is now Conley, and you know as well as I the rules that must prevail. Halleck's shoulders sagged.
My lord, if that swine is no more than a beast you'd spurn with your foot and discard the shoe because it had been contaminated. Call in an executioner if you must, or let me do it. But don't offer yourself to...
Muad'Dib need not do this thing, Chaney said.
He glanced at her, saw the fear for him in her eyes. But the Duke Paul must, he said.
This is a Harkonnen animal, Gurney rasped.
Paul hesitated on the point of revealing his own Harkonnen ancestry, stopped at a sharp look from his mother, said merely, But this being has human shape, Gurney, and deserves human doubt. Gurney said, If he's so much as...
Please stand aside, Paul said.
He hefted the kris-knife, pushed Gurney gently aside.
Gurney, Jessica said.
She touched Gurney's arm. He's like his grandfather in this mood. Don't distract him. It's the only thing you can do for him now. And she thought, Great mother, what irony. The emperor was studying Fade Rautha, seeing the heavy shoulders, the thick muscles. He turned to look at Paul, a stringy whipcord of a youth, not as desiccated as the Arakeen natives, but with ribs there to count and sunken in the flanks so that the ripple and gather of muscles could be followed under the skin. Jessica leaned close to Paul, pitched her voice for his ears alone.
One thing, son.
Sometimes a dangerous person is prepared by the Bene Gesserit, a word implanted into the deepest recesses by the old pleasure-pain methods. The word sound most frequently used is Uroshnor. If this one's been prepared, as I strongly suspect, that word uttered in his ear will render his muscles flaccid, and I want no special advantage for this one, Paul said. Step back out of my way.
Gurney spoke to her.
Why is he doing this? Does he think to get himself killed and achieve martyrdom? This Fremen religious prattle. Is that what clouds his reason?
Jessica hid her face in her hands, realizing that she did not know fully why Paul took this course. She could feel death in the room and knew that the changed Paul was capable of such a thing as Gurney suggested. Every talent within her focused on the need to protect her son, but there was nothing she could do.
"Is it this religious prattle?" Gurney insisted.
"Be silent," Jessica whispered, "and pray." The Emperor's face was touched by an abrupt smile.
"If Fade Rautha Harkonnen, of my entourage, so wishes," he said, "I relieve him of all restraint and give him freedom to choose his own course in this."
The Emperor waved a hand toward Paul's Fedaikan guards.
"One of your rabble has my belt and short blade. If Fade Rautha wishes it, he may meet you with my blade in his hand."
"I wish it," Fade Rautha said, and Paul saw the elation on the man's face. "He's overconfident," Paul thought. "There's a natural advantage I can accept."
"Get the Emperor's blade," Paul said, and watched as his command was obeyed.
"Put it on the floor there." He indicated a place with his foot.
"Clear the Imperial rabble back against the wall and let the Harkonnen stand clear."
A flurry of robes, scraping of feet, low-voiced commands and protests accompanied obedience to Paul's command. The guildsmen remained standing near the communications equipment. They frowned at Paul in obvious indecision.
"They're accustomed to seeing the future," Paul thought. "In this place and time, they're blind, even as I am."
And he sampled the time winds, sensing the turmoil, the storm nexus that now focused on this moment place. Even the faint gaps were closed now. Here was the unborn jihad he knew. Here was the race consciousness that he had known once as his own terrible purpose. Here was reason enough for a Kwisatz Haderach or a Lisan al-Ghaib, or even the halting schemes of the Bene Gesserit. The race of humans had felt its own dormancy, sensed itself grown stale, and knew now only the need to experience turmoil in which the genes would mingle and the strong new mixtures survive. All humans were alive as an unconscious single organism in this moment, experiencing a kind of sexual heat that could override any barrier. And Paul saw how futile were any efforts of his to change any smallest bit of this. He had thought to oppose the jihad within himself, but the jihad would be. His legions would rage out from Arrakis even without him. They needed only the legend he already had become. He had shown them the way, given them mastery even over the guild which must have the spice to exist. A sense of failure pervaded him, and he saw through it that Fade Rautha Harkonnen had slipped out of the torn uniform, stripped down to a fighting girdle with a mail core. This is the climax, Paul thought. From here, the future will open. The clouds part onto a kind of glory. And if I die here, they'll say I sacrificed myself that my spirit might lead them. And if I live, they'll say nothing can oppose Muad'Dib.
Is the Atreides ready? Fade Rautha called, using the words of the ancient Conley ritual. Paul chose to answer him in the Fremen way.
May thine knife chip and shatter. He pointed to the Emperor's blade on the floor, indicating that Fade Rautha should advance and take it.
keeping his attention on Paul. Fade Rautha picked up the knife, balancing it a moment in his hand to get the feel of it. Excitement kindled in him. This was a fight he had dreamed about. Man against man, skill against skill, with no shields intervening. He could see a way to power opening before him, because the Emperor surely would reward whoever killed this troublesome duke. The reward might even be that haughty daughter and a share of the throne. And this yokel duke, this back-world adventurer, could not possibly be a match for a Harkonnen trained in every device and every treachery by a thousand arena combats. And the yokel had no way of knowing he faced more weapons than a knife here. Let us see if you're proof against poison, Fade Rautha thought. He saluted Paul with the Emperor's blade, said, "Meet your death, fool." "Shall we fight, cousin?" Paul asked. And he cat-footed forward, eyes on the waiting blade, his body crouched low with his own milk-white kris-knife pointing out as though an extension of his arm. They circled each other, bare feet grating on the floor, watching with eyes intent for the slightest opening. This book is continued on Disc 21.